E pa poglej.
Kompleksne oddaje o kompleksih Evropskega parlamenta.
Projekt podpira Evropski parlament.
Dobro večer in lepo pozdravljeni v nocojšnji oddaji Epa Poglej, kjer bomo govorili o prostotrgovinskih sporazumih Evropske unije z ostalimi deli sveta. Prostotrgovinski sporazumi so način za Evropsko unijo, da se širi na nove trge čim bolj neomejeno oziroma s čim manj ovirami za pretok storitev, kapitala in ljudi. Evropska unija sama predvideva, da bo v naslednjih 10 do 15 letih 90% svetovnega povpraševanja ustvarjenega zunaj Evrope. Zato je za Evropsko unijo ključna prioriteta, da to rast povpraševanja na zunaj nekako pobere s temi prostotrgovinskimi sporazumi, ker so carine že zdaj in davki precej nizki, je glavni način za doseganje tega preko prostotrgovinskih sporazumov, tako imenovanih globokih prostotrgovinskih sporazumov, ki poleg odstranjevanja carin in davkov vključujejo tudi poenotenje oziroma harmonizacijo drugih, tako imenovanih beyond the border omejitev. To so razne omejitve, kar se tiče recimo sanitarnih pogojev in podobno. Če Evropska unija te svoje prizadevanja na področju prostotrgovinskih sporazumov upravičuje s tem, da je to velik dohodek, da bi bodo pomenili velik dohodek za Evropsko unijo in veliko novih delovnih mest. Če bi se recimo jutri končali vsi pogovori, ki trenutno potekajo na tem področju z nekimi predvidenimi izidi, bi to pomenilo kar 2,2% dodatnega BDP-ja, kar je v številke prevedeno 275 milijard evrov. V obliki držav to pomeni, kot da bi Evropski uniji dodali novo Avstrijo ali novo Dansko, ne bi pa to tudi ustvarilo 2,2 milijona novih delovnih mest. To je torej uradna interpretacija Evropske unije. Mi se bomo v oddaji pogledali tudi tisto drugo stran, da še mogoče malo razčistimo, kaj sploh pomenijo prostotrgovinski sporazumi in kaj vključujejo. Predvsem gre za odpiranje novih trgov za storitve in dobrine. S tem ne bi se povečale priložnosti za investicije, pocenilo ne bi se trgovanje, trgovanje ne bi bilo tudi hitrejše zaradi lažjega tranzita. Poleg tega pa bi se to okolje za izvajanje politik med državami naredilo bolj predvidljivo z vsemi temi prejšnjimi ukrepi. Ta teden je mogoče ta oddaja še bolj aktualna zaradi trenutno potekajočih pogajanj v Bruslju glede tako imenovanega TTIP-a, to je Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership. Gre za prostotrgovinski sporazum med Evropsko unijo in Združenimi državami Amerike. Evropska unija uradno pojasnjuje, da gre za trgovinski sporazum, ki cilja na odpravo ovir trgovanju, ker davki in carine so že tako ali tako precej nizki. Gre torej za odpravo teh beyond the border ovir za trgovanju, predvsem gre za odpravo nepotrebnih regulacij, omejitev za investicije in podobno. Ta svoje pogajanja spet upravičujejo s tem finančnim vidikom, ker ne bi to pomenilo za Evropsko unijo dodatnih 119 milijard na leto oziroma 545 evrov za vsako gospodinstvo. Je pa ta sporazum povzročil veliko razburjenje v civilni družbi, delno zaradi skrivnostnosti pri samem sprejemanju tega sporazuma, delno pa zaradi škodljivosti za Evropsko unijo. Ta harmonizacija, o kateri smo govorili, tako imenovana omejitev trgovanja, namreč pomeni manj nadzora na več področjih, kar se tiče Evropske unije. Pri tem gre predvsem za iskanje nekako najmanjšega skupnega imenovalca med zakonodajama Evropske unije in Združenih držav Amerike, in to predvsem, in to na obeh stranih Atlantika pomeni nekako bolj ohlapno zakonodajo na več področjih. Za Evropsko unijo ne bi to pomenilo, recimo samo eno od takih področji je, da bi to praktično pomenilo izginotje trajnostnega kmetovanja. Evropska zakonodaja se bo namreč mogla nekako poenotiti ali oziroma prilagoditi bolj ohlapnim ameriškim pravilom, recimo na področju zaščite živali, na področju uporabe pesticidov. Je pa takih, pa recimo na področju prehrambene varnosti, genetsko spremenjenih organizmov in tako naprej, ima pa skoraj vsako področje, pa vsaka nevladna organizacija ali pa aktivistična organizacija, ki se ukvarja s posameznim področjem, pripombe za to svoje področje, ker ne bi se povsod nekako zmanjšala varnost. V oddaji bomo poslušali pogovore s tremi sogovorniki, najprej pa poslušamo izjavo Relin Kneterus iz Centra za raziskovanje multinacionalnih korporacij.
Currently, the trade relations between Europe and these countries basically relate to trade in goods. And what they're trying to do is to negotiate further agreements that will take into account also the liberalization of services, of government procurement, for example, and of investment, and to use these to set these countries firmly on a path towards a neoliberal trade model with a reduction of all kinds of market barriers, including market barriers behind borders, with the idea to sort of irreversibly lock in liberalizations and create market opening for transnational corporations.
Roslin Knoterus nam je torej pojasnila, kako potekajo pogajanja za sprejetje prostotrgovinskih sporazumov s severnoafriškimi državami. Zato smo jo vprašali, kaj so posebnosti, ki so jih izpostavili posamezne države ali pa ki jih je Evropska unija od posameznih držav zahtevala.
Yeah, well, the European Union sees all those kind of restrictions as barriers to trade and investment and they would like to see them removed. But a lot of these countries also have restrictions in place. For example, in Egypt is very strong on that. They have a lot of restrictions saying, okay, if foreign investment comes into the country, we have a requirement saying that they have to hire a certain amount of local staff or they have to use a certain amount of local raw materials, which are instruments that help harness this foreign investment for national development rather than have multinationals come in, bring in their own staff, their own resources, do their own thing basically in your country and then repatriating all the profits. These are all regulations that kind of help harness investment for national development. So it would be very bad if these kind of restrictions would have to be removed, but that is what the European Union wants. They want unlimited access for foreign investors, and they think these kind of requirements are all very cumbersome, and they want them gone, basically.
Slišimo torej lahko, da je Evropska unija precej agresivna oziroma, če tako hočemo, dosledna pri upeljevanju liberalizacije trga. Posameznim državam sicer uspe ohraniti nekaj omejitev na za njih ključnih področjih. Maroko je tako recimo prepovedal vlaganje v področje fosfatov, Egipt je dal za pogoj za vlaganje evropskih podjetij v področje energetike. Pogoj je to, da lahko evropska podjetja v ta sektor vlagajo le skupaj z lokalnimi podjetji. Roslin Knoterus smo pa zato vprašali, kaj EU ponuja v zameno, glede na to, da je v takih pogajanjih ponavadi zaradi velikosti svojega trga in ter politične in gospodarske moči ponavadi močnejši pogajalec. Poleg tega pa tudi sama med tem, ko usiljuje nekako liberalizacijo drugim državam, recimo s subvencijami kmetijstvu in podobnem, svojega trga ne odpira tako dosledno kot to pričakuje od svojih partnerjev.
Yeah, I think that the reasoning is that they will that these countries will receive unlimited access to the European market. They have lots of opportunities to take their business into Europe, and the European Union will provide them with will help them on their way to integration into the single European market. And the European Union says that this will boost the development in these countries. But of course, that only helps if you can take advantage of that kind of opportunity, which means that you will already have to be quite a big economic player. And it's definitely not going to help a lot of small producers, which are the backbone of the economic structures in these countries. So it's basically a project that's for and by economic elites. It's the big multinational companies from Europe that will profit. It's the powerful economic elites from the DCFTA countries that might profit. And all the smallholders, all the small producers will definitely not benefit from this kind of thing.
Zanimiv je primer Egipta, ki je pod zdaj že nekdanjim predsednikom Mubarakom zelo lepo sledil tem neoliberalnim reformam, usiljenim od zune, od različnih mednarodnih institucij. Ko pa je na oblast prišel Morsi, je ta želel nekako začeti proces nacionalizacije, vendar so bili zaradi teh že prej sklenjenih pogodb med Evropsko unijo in tudi z drugimi regijami in državami, Egipt je imel zaradi tega precej zvezane roke glede sprejemanja novih politik. Govori Relin Knotterus.
Yeah, well, if you want to change that kind of policy, the thing with trade and investment treaties is that you put all these obligations to liberalize in a treaty and then they become almost irreversible. So if you try to reverse them, the treaty says, okay, you will have to compensate investors. So in Egypt, the perverse situation was that many of these investors acquired certain assets in a corrupt way and often at prices that were very much below their real economic value. But then when a new government tries to reverse that, they will then have to pay compensation to these same corrupt investors because they're violating treaty obligations. So yeah, this is one of the big problems that we have with these treaties, is that they limit the policy space of future governments. So any government that concludes a treaty like that and says, okay, we will liberalize these sectors and we will give these guarantees to foreign investors and blah, 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 those are then all set in stone. So any government, and like you said, regardless of what you think of Morsi, but any government that has a different political economic view and that would like to change certain policies and maybe re-nationalize public services or, you know, put in stricter environmental regulations, those kind of things would then be cause for international investors to say, look, we invested under different conditions, you're now trying to reverse those conditions, we have the right under the treaty to a stable investment environment, this is no longer a stable investment environment, so therefore you have to give us monetary compensation for the changes you're trying to bring. So this is actually really interfering with democratic rulemaking.
Kot smo že povedali, je poleg vsebinske spornosti sporen tudi postopek sprejemanja teh prostotrgovinskih sporazumov. Pomemben je vpliv nevladnih organizacij in raznih poročil, ki jih te organizacije izdajajo. Namreč veliko teh prostotrgovinskih sporazumov je sprejetih pod precej močnim pritiskom velikih mednarodnih korporacij, zato smo Relin Knotterus, ki dela v enem od nevladnih organizacij, ki je z lobiranjem in poročili proba poskuša vplivati na javno mnenje in tudi na odločevalce, vprašali, kakšna je vloga civilne družbe v postopku sprejemanja teh prostotrgovinskih sporazumov.
Well, the problem with the sustainable impact assessment is that they seem to have very little impact. First of all, they're often quite narrow in scope, so they don't look at all the controversial areas. They do have a civil society consultation usually, but those consultations are also usually quite narrow. Plus, the whole process of developing the sustainable impact assessment is usually in parallel to negotiations that are just trade and investment negotiations that are ongoing. And it's completely unclear how any findings from the sustainable impact assessment impacts the actual negotiations. And sometimes even conclusions from sustainable impact assessments are produced after the negotiations have reached a critical stage. So, it doesn't seem to influence the whole process a lot, which in itself is quite a bad thing. I think you would, in my view, you would have to first assess what the negative impacts will be and then decide whether and how you want to shape your trade and investment relations. And now it's basically, I mean, it's quite telling that the European Union has a civil society consultation on the sustainable impact assessments that they're now doing for two of the DCFTA countries. And they say this is a sustainable impact assessment in support of trade and investment negotiations. So that already shows that, yeah, they will be supporting these negotiations. And the whole question of saying, well, maybe we shouldn't have these negotiations or maybe we shouldn't take them that far, it's just not a question. And if you look at an older impact assessment that they did for the DCFTA countries, they had arrived at very damaging conclusions. And nothing was done with that except that they changed the bureau that is conducting the sustainable impact assessment. So they had the University of Manchester, I think, was doing the initial sustainability impact assessment. That was quite damaging for the EU's trade and investment agenda for these countries because it listed a lot of very negative impacts in the DCFTA countries. And now they've done a few new sustainable impact assessments for this next round of negotiations. And they've just changed the institution that's conducting the investigation. So, you know, they just use this process to further the trade and investment agenda. And what they will do is they will look at, okay, where are the deepest damages expected? And there might have to be some flanking policies or things like that. So that in that way it does get used, but not in any kind of fundamental way. I think it's an ongoing struggle for those people in civil society and maybe also the policymakers interested in these areas versus the people who conduct the trade and investment negotiations who seem to be very single-minded in, okay, we need neoliberal trade and that is what we're going for. And they don't really, there is no real policy coherence in that they really include concerns in all these related areas in the actual trade negotiations and in the trade negotiating agenda. So this is something that we're definitely, as civil society, we continue to argue for, like, okay, look at all the different areas that trade will have an impact on and make sure that you're coherent in what you want in terms of policy. But it doesn't seem to be happening. It seems to be that trade and investment relations are still being shaped in isolation without taking into consideration all these other areas. Or maybe to a very limited extent only.
Kot smo slišali, so prostotrgovinski sporazumi na področju Severne Afrike precej neoliberalno usmerjeni tako, da koristijo predvsem velikemu biznisu, velikemu kapitalu, ne pa toliko ljudem. Zato smo Relin Kneteru so vprašali, kakšen vpliv na družbo v regiji imajo prostotrgovinski sporazumi, še posebej v luči arabskih revolucij, ki so se dogajale lansko leto.
Well, I think that these policies work towards a concentration of wealth in the hands of elites. So I think, and it also shows from the recent sustainability impact assessments that the EU has commissioned, that income inequality in these countries as a result of these trade policies will rise, even though the new sustainability impact assessments say that this effect is only limited, whereas the old one said it was much more sharp. But I think on the whole, the dynamics of these neoliberal economic policies are to create more inequality and a bigger concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. And I think that's something that definitely clashes with the aspirations of the Arab Spring. And I'm not saying that these neoliberal policies were the reason for the uprisings and the regime change and things, but they were definitely a factor. I mean, people were experiencing inequality, and I think neoliberal policies were definitely contributing to that. And the EU is now, with its new negotiations, trying to take these neo or these liberalizations further and set them in stone. So yeah, it doesn't bode well for equality in a society, I think.
Mi se sedaj iz Severne Afrike in njihovih izkušenj s prostotrgovinskimi sporazumi pomikamo na Južno južno oziroma podsaharsko Afriko. O tem področju oziroma o tem regiji bomo govorili s Stevenom Hurtom, profesorjem mednarodnih odnosov na Oxford Brookes University. Hurta smo najprej vprašali, da nam oziroma prosili, da nam oriše zgodovino sporazuma Evropske unije oziroma gospodarskega sodelovanja Evropske unije in njenih prejšnjih reinkarnacij s podsaharsko Afriko. Najprej je bilo namreč, so bile namreč odnose s podsaharsko Afriko predvsej postkolonialni, kar se tiče trgovalnih sporazumov oziroma trgovinskih sporazumov, so se te osredotočali predvsem na posamezne izdelke, recimo kavo in podobno. Po 80-ih oziroma tej znani neoliberalni revoluciji pa se je, so se začeli prostotrgovinski sporazumi prilagajati tudi politično oziroma so postali tudi orodje neke ideološke indoktrinacije in so začeli vključevati tudi zahteve po demokratizaciji oziroma tudi institucionalni prilagoditvi posameznih držav. Govori Stephen Hurt.
There's been various incarnations of what we now call the EU, but the relations between, I guess, Europe and Africa go back, or the trade relations we have now, you can trace back certainly to the post-colonial period of the sort of 1960s and early 1970s. So to begin with, you had these two the two Yaoundé conventions, which were the first sort of EU-Africa agreements. And they were largely just more of the same, the kind of post-colonial trade relations. And things changed quite significantly in 1975. You had the first so-called Lomé Convention signed, and that was quite different. And I think to understand EU's policy to Africa more broadly, you need to always sort of contextualize it within dominant ideas and dominant thinking of the time more globally. So that point, mid-1970s, you had the calls for a new international economic order by many developing countries. You had the OPEC oil crisis of the 73-74. And so the view then was that, you know, African states needed to be protected from unilateral trade liberalization. They needed this to help with their development. So the first Lomé Convention in the mid-1970s did actually offer the African, Caribbean and Pacific so-called ACP states non-reciprocal trade preferences. So they would get access to Europe, but they wouldn't have to open up the other way around to allow European exporters access to their markets. Through the various re-signings of the Lomé Conventions, as you said in your question, things start to change. Europe starts to bring in during the 1980s demands for democratization, human rights, the more political side of development, if you like. And you start to get on the economic side a sort of adoption of the neoliberal ideas, which start to become dominant from the sort of early 1980s more globally with the World Bank and IMF, etc. Okay, so I guess by the early 1990s, really, the EU is largely moving towards this neoliberal line of thinking, away from the kind of ideas that they brought in Lomé. And this eventually leads to the Cotonou Agreement, which was signed in 2000. And one of the key justifications for signing that agreement was that the deal they had at the time, Lomé, didn't meet WTO rules for what you can do in terms of a regional agreement between two partners, where you have to liberalize the majority of trade, or I think the WTO language is substantially all. Of course, you have to interpret what substantially all is. It tends to be, historically, it's been about 90% of the trade between the two partners. So you've gone from a position where trade was seen as something that could benefit ACP states, but they needed to protect their markets because they're the industrializers, they're the developing countries, to a position where liberalization is seen as beneficial for all partners. And that's really what was sort of cemented in the Cotonou Agreement.
Ta opisana spremenjena načela svetovnega trgovanja so se še bolj zakoličila z Lizbonsko pogodbo, po kateri je za oblikovanje in pogajanje o prostotrgovinskih sporazumih postala odgovorna Evropska komisija. Predtem se je o tem pogajal Svet Evropske unije, torej ministri pristojni za posamezna področja, kjer bi lahko rekli, da še je prevladovalo nekaj takega, čemu rečemo nacionalni interes. Zdaj, ko pa je to prevzela Evropska komisija, so pogajanja in tudi izidi predvsej bolj ideološko konsistentni.
Prior to Lisbon, we already had, in terms of Europe, when Europe negotiates trade agreements, it's negotiated at a European level now. And so the Commission has a key role. I mean, the particular thing about its relations with Africa is that prior to the economic partnership agreement things, which I'm sure we'll come on to, which form part of Cotonou, the main arm of the Commission which was dealing with Africa was DG Development, as it was known, rather than trade. And what's happened now is the sort of DG Development has, I think, been subsumed to some extent, and DG Trade, given that the main arrangement now is going to be these economic partnership agreements, they're the ones negotiating them, just as they would negotiate with the US as they are now, or South Korea, or wherever they're negotiating a trade agreement with. So the main arm of the Commission is now, for Africa, is actually DG Trade and not DG Development. Of course, you know, you could raise questions about whether it's now still about development or whether it's now about more hard-headed kind of trade interests. So in a sense, those changes came before Lisbon. I mean, the Parliament now with Lisbon has to rubber stamp things and has a small role to play. So there was some discussion about the imposition of deadlines recently, and the Parliament wanted to delay what the Commission wanted, etc., etc. But the Parliament's still fairly marginalised in these processes, I would argue.
Stevena Hurta smo v nadaljevanju vprašali, kakšen je dejanski ekonomski vpliv evropskih prostotrgovinskih sporazumov. Kaj so torej konkretni ukrepi, ki jih Evropa nekako zahteva od afriških in drugih držav pod to zastavo liberalizacije, kateri sektori pridobijo in kateri izgubijo?
So the EPA is, as I said, a part of one of the key pillars, if you like, of the Cotonou Agreement. And again, they're part of a much broader trend in terms of pretty much ever since the World Trade Organization was formed back in the mid-1990s. The way trade is going is not actually multilateral anymore, with the failures to conclude a meaningful Doha round, but actually bilateral. So we've had a huge growth in bilateral free trade agreements. Not just the EU, but the US and other key players, where they've struggled to get things on the table in the WTO. They've moved to do it on a bilateral basis. So the negotiations for economic partnership agreements go right back to 2002. And what you had was the breaking up of the African Caribbean Pacific group into smaller subgroups, eventually seven. And they were meant to be concluded by the end of 2007. Which was when the waiver for the WTO expired. But by that point, only the Caribbean region had actually signed a comprehensive EPA. The rest of the groups either didn't sign anything, or some countries signed what were known as interim ones. And that's just covering the liberalisation of trade in goods, nothing else. The EU, on the other hand, wanted much more, as I think you said in your opening question, much more kind of comprehensive agreements, not just trade liberalisation, but a whole series of other things. And that's where the main debate is. They would argue that the kind of comprehensive nature of, I guess we could call it a deep integration approach that goes beyond just free trade agreements, they would argue, the Commission would argue, that this is the kind of added value, this is the developmental bit, this is why it's not just another free trade agreement. So there's a focus on regulatory systems for business, which they would argue would then attract foreign investors, would add value to the African states. There's a focus on regionalization within these subgroups of the ACP, whether it's West Africa, East Africa, Southern Africa, etc. And there's added finance that comes from the aid part of the EU, the European Development Fund. So they aren't exactly the same in sense, they would argue, as what they might do if they negotiated with another part of the world. However, as your question intimated, there are not just me, but a number of people, both African negotiators, non-governmental organisations, who for a number of years have been raising questions about what the impact will actually be. Now, given that we haven't actually had full EPA's agreed with any African region yet, although West Africa seems pretty much there just in the last couple of months. What the impact will be is largely theoretical, because we don't know yet, but the EU would give a very optimistic scenario about the benefits. I would have more skepticism. So I think there are a number of problems. Firstly, you've got who has to do the liberalisation in the agreement. As I said, we need to get to 90% overall trade between the two partners. The EU has pretty much opened its markets to these countries already. So the states that are doing the liberalising are the African states. And many of those states are already, if they're less developed countries, they already have access to the EU on a duty-free, quota-free basis. So they're opening up with no added gain from the other side. They've already got access to the European market. Secondly, you have, as you start to reduce barriers to trade, you, in terms of tariffs, for example, you lose the revenue that you generate through tariffs, which for some countries, some smaller countries, particularly Southern Africa, I'm talking about here, Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland, etc., they're pretty reliant on that for government revenue. So, if they don't have that revenue coming in, how are they going to fund the kind of things that the state needs to fund? But I think the main issue for me, it certainly is, this focus on a much deeper integration, the kind of regulatory aspects of it, and in particular the so-called Singapore issues coming into these agreements, which were something that in the WTO back in the early 2000s, African states were dead set that they didn't want the EU to put the Singapore issues on the table. And there was kind of a rather pyrrhic victory, as it turns out, in 2003 when at Cancun in the WTO negotiations, these were kind of, the African states walked away from the table and there was a collapse in the talks. But what's happened is since, the EU in particular has then brought these issues through these negotiations bilaterally. So here we're talking about including investment rules, we're talking about competition policy, we're talking about government procurement. Three things which would basically mean you'd have to treat European firms exactly the same as any domestic firms. So this means, you know, for sort of regulatory policy for these states, if they wanted to prioritize a domestic provider for a government function, or try and build up an industrial sector, which is obviously one of the main problems in many African states, they need to diversify their economies, they would be largely constrained, because these companies would have to compete on a level playing field with, you know, European firms who would obviously be far more powerful and more efficient. So it's going to limit the kind of scope, I think, for these countries to then set their own policy agenda and to try and adopt a strategy that isn't, you know, based purely on liberalisation.
Ne glede na vse kritike, pa tudi afriške države imajo nekaj prednosti od teh prostotrgovinskih sporazumov. Nedvomno je vsaj malenkostna rast bruto domačega proizvoda iz tega naslova, vendar pa to, kot vemo, ni ravno pokazatelj nekaj dobrobiti prebivalstva. Zato smo Stevena Hurta vprašali, kako je novo bogatstvo v podsaharski Afriki porazdeljeno. Novo bogatstvo, ki izhaja iz teh prostotrgovinskih sporazumov.
I mean, there's been lots of quantitative studies done to try and justify the potential impact about possible growth in GDP, etc. I mean, the kind of people who could stand to benefit would be exporting, the kind of exporting sector, presumably. Although many of them already have access, but the danger is that the any sort of nascent manufacturing industry or sectors of the economy which aren't going to be able to compete with European investors are going to find themselves swamped by Europe. Now, what impact this has on sort of simple measures like GDP growth, it's hard to say. But as you say, even if there is growth as a result of this, the question is then, where does that growth end up? Now, partly that's down to the government policies. Do they have a redistributive tax system, etc., as to how they try and spread those benefits? And I guess to some extent the EU is not dictating terms at that level yet. But I think there are a number of concerns, and many African negotiators who, you know, are elites, the people doing the negotiating, have for a long time actually proved quite resistant, given the power relationship with them and the EU. The fact that these things haven't been agreed for so long is actually kind of quite interesting. And it's taken the EU now to put a deadline of the 1st of October, where they will take away the trade preferential access to Europe beyond that point if they don't look like they're going to sign an agreement. It's taken a kind of threat of a deadline to try and move these negotiations forward. But we've been talking about these for over a decade now. So there must be something wrong with them, otherwise Africa would have signed up much more quickly.
Kot smo slišali, predvideni prostotrgovinski sporazumi s temi afriškimi državami oziroma European Partnership Agreements še niso bili podpisani, vendar pa smo Stevena Harta vseeno vprašali, kaj so alternative za afriške države, glede na to, da v pogajanjih za prostotrgovinske sporazume bolj ali manj vedno izgubijo, pač pridobijo mogoče malo več, malo manj, ampak v končni fazi so pa nas največkrat na slabšem oziroma nekem podrejenem položaju. Zato smo Harta vprašali, če morda priložnost v regionalnem povezovanju.
Well, one of the problematic impacts of EIPAs would be that because they've been negotiated with regional groups within Africa, and because some, it's quite complicated, but in various different regions, some states are involved, some aren't, it's kind of undermining the still quite exploratory groups that have been set up across Africa. So, I mean, I'm not an optimist for Pan-Africanism necessarily. I don't see the African Union, for example, as they've got some very lofty ambitions to have a common currency across Africa and free trade across Africa. I'm not sure that's necessarily going to be realized anytime soon. But I think what is interesting, if you take the time frame of the negotiations on economic partnership agreements, that I mentioned in an earlier question that the sort of general ideological climate informs these kinds of things. So in the 1970s, you know, we weren't in the period of neoliberalism, so there was a different view. Then from the 80s, we kind of had the neoliberal agenda. Now, yes, the EU and the World Bank still largely pursues a neoliberal agenda to development, but there are alternatives around, and in particular I'm thinking here about China and other key actors. And what's happened with China and other states in the sort of emerging global south is that they offer an alternative now. Policymakers in Africa look to the EU and they look to the World Bank, but they also look to China and they kind of think, well, here's an alternative. What's happening there, and how is that different to what the EU is asking us to do? And so I think there are potential alternatives. I mean, an interesting reflection of this was the UNDP published its annual Human Development Report last year, and it always picks up on a kind of theme, and the theme was the rise of the South. And the kind of key conclusions of that document were that actually states were actually very important for development in the developing world, that they need to regulate markets, they need to support industrial development, and they need to kind of strategically engage with the global economy, which is a very different way of thinking about it to the kind of neoliberal view that you just open up, you liberalize, and you let the market do its magic. Here there's a very much a strategic engagement with the global market, and China is obviously is a key example here, where they've played a kind of a very strong state-led role in the way they engage with the global economy. So I think now there are alternatives, and this is making it quite hard for the EU negotiators to convince African policymakers that, you know, what they're offering is the only solution to development, because there are other ideas around now. So I think that's the kind of broader context now for these negotiations, that it's not the only game in town. Neoliberalism isn't the only alternative anymore. I'm a indirect.
repofeni muneri no pasi amai nirimo amai nirimo amai nirepofeni muneri no pasi amai nirimo amai nirimo chene tonga merera wewe Mambo muneri no pasi vakapa vakasorora mambo vakapa vakasorora mambo vakapa vakasorora iwe muneri no pasi vakapa vakasorora mambo vakapa vakasorora mambo cheretonga merera wewe deyo oye one ndivanga oye one ndivaba oye one ndivanga Woman, Tayaura. Oye, one in the Yamada. Oye, one in the Wayamada. Marumiwe, Tashupika. Oye, one in the Wayamada. Oye, one in the
Dobrodošli nazaj v oddajo Epa Poglej, kjer nocoj govorimo o prostotrgovinskih sporazumih med Evropsko unijo in ostalim svetom. V prejšnjem delu oddaje smo že govorili z Zorelin Knoterus, ki je predstavila potekanje sklepanja prostotrgovinskih sporazumov in njegove posledice za Severno Afriko in Stevenom Hurtom, ki je na podoben način govoril o podsaharski Afriki. Kot smo lahko slišali, so osnovni principi in tudi načini pogajanj precej podobni, zato se bomo v nadaljevanju osredotočili ne na še katero od regij, recimo temu tretjega sveta, ampak na pogajanja glede transatlantskega sporazuma o prosti trgovini, to pomeni sporazuma med Evropsko unijo in Združenimi državami Amerike. Na tem področju je v bistvu najbolj sporno poglavje tega sporazuma, tako imenovani State Investor Dispute. Cecilio Olivier, raziskovalko na Transnational Institute v Amsterdamu, smo prosili, da opiše, kaj sploh je State Investor Dispute.
Usually you have investment treaties signed between two governments. There are over 3,000 between different governments around the world. And most of these treaties include a mechanism that allows for investors to sue states at international arbitration tribunals whenever they feel that their profits have been affected in any way by measures taken by the government. So, as I was saying, this is a mechanism embedded in bilateral investment treaties or investment agreements in general. It can also be free trade agreements that include an investment protection chapter. For example, a very typical one is NAFTA, the free trade area of the Americas, the United States, Canada, and Mexico are part of. And this was one of the first free trade agreements that included this investment protection chapter. But the key characteristic is that it allows investors to bypass national courts or regional courts and go to these international arbitration tribunals. And even though the treaty is signed between states, it grants this right investors.
Kot smo omenili že na začetku, da je prav ta teden v Bruslu potekajo pogajanja, nov krog pogajanj o sprejetju tega sporazuma, torej sporazuma med prostotrgovinskega sporazuma med ZDA in Evropsko unijo. Glede na to, da je trgovanje med obema regijama oziroma področjema praktično prosto in ni nobenih omejitev, se osredotočajo pogajanja predvsem na to, kar je opisala v prejšnjem odgovoru Cecilia Olivier, torej State Investor Dispute, in pa na odpravljanje teh Beyond the Border ovir. V nadaljevanju smo zato Cecilio Olivier vprašali, kaj State Investor Dispute pomeni za države, kaj so posledice in kako je bilo s temi tožbami do sedaj.
Well, the consequence of including this clause or this mechanism in investment agreements is that investors have been, you know, especially over the last years, the last 10 years, I would say, using it increasingly, meaning there is a boom of investor-to-state lawsuits. So there is a really big amount of lawsuits of investors against states, and there's been an increase in the last 10 years. So for example, 2012, this is according to statistics from UNCTAD, is the year when most lawsuits were launched against governments in one single year. There were 52 cases. There are about 530 known investment disputes worldwide. We always say known because one characteristic of this mechanism and this situation is that a lot of the times you just don't know about these cases because they don't have the obligation to make them public. And for example, if the investor or the state wants to keep it in secret, they can. So there is around 530 disputes that they are registered, we know about, but these people that are into the issue will tell you that this is probably the tip of the iceberg. It's very likely that the real number of investor-to-state disputes are much, much higher than those 530. But if you also look throughout the years, you will see a deep increase in the number of lawsuits, particularly between 2001, let's say, until 2013. Before that, there were some lawsuits, but there were not as many.
Kot smo slišali, torej je Evropa načeloma že do sedaj, oziroma Evropa podjetja sedežem v Evropski uniji so lahko že sedaj tožila nekatere tretje države. Zdaj pa bodo te sklenitvijo teh različnih prostotrgovinskih sporazumov tožile tudi Evropo. Med sabo so se sicer evropske države oziroma podjetja iz različnih evropskih držav kljub možnosti tožila bolj poredko. Govori Cecilia Olivi.
Usually these agreements that I was talking about, they are signed between European countries, for example, and countries from the south, governments from the south. That was the traditional type of treaties. So, for example, Europe with Asian countries, with Latin American, with African. And as I was saying, these treaties were mainly signed during the 90s, and this was the formula. So even though they are bilateral treaties and both parties, so both states would have the same rights or obligations, and in principle, the investors from both states could sue the other, in practice, in reality, what happens is that usually it was European companies suing countries of the South, like either Latin American, Asians, or Africans. So when you look at the statistics about the cases, there were very few, actually, you know, you could count them with one hand, the amount of cases against European countries. Well, that is now, with the crisis, what we're seeing is a slight change. There's a few cases before the crisis. An emblematic one, you could say, is a case against Germany. Germany was sued by a company called Vattenfall, a Swedish company, and the lawsuit is a result of the decision of the German government to phase out nuclear energy. And then this was a decision taken by the German government after the Fukushima disaster in Japan. They decided to close down all of their nuclear power plants, and as a result of that decision, they've been sued. But this was in fact the first lawsuit against Germany that we've known about, and the lawsuits against European countries are very, very few. With the European crisis, when that broke down, what we are seeing now is a new wave of lawsuits as a result of measures taken during the crisis. Now, I should make also the difference that when I talk about Europe being sued very little, I'm talking about Western European countries, not Eastern European or Central Eastern European countries. Because if you look at the number of lawsuits in terms of regions, Latin America goes first by far. It's the region in the world that has been sued the most. But the second one is Central and Eastern Europe. And it's very, very different, the situation of Central and Eastern Europe than Western Europe in that sense, because Western European countries have been almost not sued at all, while Eastern and Central European countries have been sued heavily, particularly Czech Republic, Hungary. Those countries have really been dealing with a lot of lawsuits in the last couple of years. With the crisis, what we've seen now is new lawsuits coming in against particularly Greece, Cyprus, Spain, and also Belgium. And all these different lawsuits are a result of measures taken as a result or in the context of economic crisis. So the situation is slightly changing. I mean, we would say that in a way, Europe, Western Europe had been spared so far, but now they're also feeling the consequences of these agreements. They're starting to be at the receiving end of these lawsuits. It's still not the same amount that in other regions, but we fear that if an agreement, a trade and investment agreement, is signed with the United States, there will be the possibility for many, many more lawsuits to come, because we know also from the statistics that 64% of all the lawsuits worldwide are initiated by U.S. companies. Now, currently, Western European countries don't have this protection mechanism for companies with the U.S. There are no investment agreements in place. But if the TTIP, the U.S.-EU trade and investment agreement is signed, there will be that protection, that extra layer of protection given to corporations, both Europeans and U.S. corporations. But in the current context, we feel that that could open the floodgates for a new wave of lawsuits against European countries, and particularly the most vulnerable ones, which are the countries in crisis. So people who are already suffering the cuts and their austerity measures will now have to bear the consequences and the costs of also paying for these lawsuits.
Kot smo slišali, je tudi v teh pogajanjih zelo pomembna vloga Evropske komisije. Kot je povedala že Cecilia Olivier, namreč praktičnih ovir za trgovanje ni, obstajajo pa ovire v obliki teh beyond the border omejitev. Zato Cecilia Olivier smo zato vprašali, za koga se komisija pogaja in v čigavem interesu, saj je očitno edina ovira, ki jo mednarodni kapital še ima pri vlaganju v državah, te neki notranji predpisi glede standardov in podobno. Govori Cecilia Olivier.
Until 2009, when the Lisbon Treaty was signed, the competencies between the European Commission and the member states were divided. The member states had the competence to negotiate and agree to investment protection, while the European Commission had the competence to open markets. So that's why European member states have signed over the years around 1,500 bilateral investment treaties, which include these investment protections that I'm mentioning. So with the Lisbon Treaty, these changes, that competence in terms of investment protection moves from the member states to the European Commission. Therefore, the European Commission now has the authority to negotiate not only free trade agreements that will help with the opening of markets, market access, but they can also include a special chapter within the free trade agreements that is dedicated to investment protection after the investors have entered the market of a third country. So that is quite a big difference that happened with the Lisbon Treaty. So as a result of that change, after 2009, all the free trade agreements that the European Union has initiated, they all include the negotiation of a separate and a specific investment protection chapter that will be included in this free trade agreement. That is currently happening with many Southeast Asian countries, for example, with Singapore, with Malaysia, with Vietnam, with Thailand, but also with Canada and with India. So all those negotiations that started after 2009 now have this investment protection chapter that the European Commission has now the mandate to also negotiate. And more recently then, the same is happening with the U.S. So if these negotiations with the U.S. would have started before 2009, it would have been the European Commission could not be negotiating this investment protection mechanism. They could not negotiate this possibility of investors to sue states, because all that belonged to the member states. But because this negotiation is happening after the Lisbon Treaty, now the Commission is allowed to do it and to negotiate this new rights for investors. We would argue that this agreement is definitely in favor of big business. I mean, when you look at the text, particularly the investment protection chapter, you will see that what the European Commission is negotiating is its greater rights for U.S. investors and for European investors than for any national companies. And they're also only granting rights. They're not demanding any type of obligations from these investors. So, and when we're talking investors, we're not talking small and medium enterprises. We're talking big corporations that have the opportunity and the size and the money to invest abroad, because the national investors will not be protected by this agreement. This is only will only grant protection to, for example, European investors that are operating in the U.S. or U.S. investors operating in Europe. But European investors operating in Europe will not be protected by the same level of rights. So in a way, we would argue that, yeah, this investment, trade and investment agreement, TTIP, gives foreign investors VIP treatment.
Glede na povedano, smo za konec Cecilio Olivezo zastavili še morda malo naivno vprašanje, to je, kaj se dogaja v teh procesih z demokracijo, tako na nacionalnem nivoju, tako tudi na evropskem. Na nacionalnem je namreč state investor dispute način, da se podjetja izognejo vsem nekako nacionalnim sodiščem, gre praktično za privatizacijo pravice oziroma sodišč, ker se te state investor dispute izvajajo na privatnih arbitražnih sodiščih ali pa na arbitražnih sodiščih posameznih mednarodnih organizacij, kot je Svetovna banka, ki niso predmet demokratičnega nadzora. Na evropskem nivoju pa, pa so pogajanja o teh prostotrgovinskih sporazumih tudi precej izključujoča. Evropski parlament ima, kot smo že slišali, precej zgolj niti ne posvetovalno, pač pa samo odobrilno vlogo. Poleg tega pa je tudi vpliv civilne družbe oziroma teh raznih skupin, ki se prizadevajo za večjo transparentnost ali pa mogoče za bolj trajnostni razvoj, precej omejen. Njihov dostop je omejen le na nekatere likane dokumente, medtem ko se predstavniki teh večjih podjetij in z boljšim kapitalskim ozadjem lahko bolj uspešno lobirajo. Cecilio Olivezo smo torej za konec vprašali, kaj se dogaja z demokracijo glede prostotrgovinskih sporazumov.
Yeah, from our perspective, TTIP is a big assault on democratic rights and democratic processes, not only because the treaty is being signed, it's been negotiated under closed doors in secret. We don't have access to the texts, we don't have access to the negotiations. We don't know exactly what is being negotiated except for the few leaks that we got hold of. So that's a big problem in itself. But from what we know, and taking the cue from other treaties that have been signed, investment treaties that have been signed, we know that this mechanism that allows investors to sue states definitely undermines democracy, because it takes the decision-making power regarding sovereign decisions taken by states to be decided by private individuals, three private individuals, at a forum that is completely out of the spectrum of the national justice system. So it's a privatization of justice. It's three private individuals with vested financial interests that are deciding on measures and regulations taken by sovereign states. For example, just to give you a very concrete example, the government of Uruguay is being sued by Philip Morris because they decided to increase the size of warning in the cigarette packages. Philip Morris is able, because of this bilateral investment treaty between Switzerland and Uruguay, they're able to claim that that's, that undermines their rights, that their rights have been violated, that increasing the size of warning in cigarette packages is it's an expropriation of their intellectual property rights, and therefore they're able to sue. They're suing at an international tribunal called ICSID. ICSID, it's this tribunal under the auspices of the World Bank. And as I said, there will be three private individuals which have vested interest because they are being paid by the parties that will decide whether Uruguay was right or wrong in implementing these measures, regardless of the fact that that was a sovereign decision, it was in the interest of public health, the government of Uruguay was following the recommendations of the World Health Organization. But all of that is not taken into account when the decision is made whether the government is liable or not and has to compensate the company.
Takole zaključujemo nocojšnjo oddajo EPA Poglej. Poslušalcem pa svetujemo, da spremljajo razvoj dogodkov v zvezi s transatlantskim prostotrgovinskim sporazumom, kjer utekne biti še bolj zanimiv, kot je predogajanje okoli akte. Oddajo EPA Poglej smo pripravili Jaša Janković in Jure za tehnično pomočjo.
EPA Poglej.
Kompleksne oddaje o kompleksih Evropskega parlamenta.
Projekt podpira Evropski parlament.